Okay. Yep. I'm Rose. I'm the nurse practitioner in Madison, Wisconsin.
And closer to the microphone, please.
Okay. Great. All right. So this case is called The Great Imitator Strikes Again, and I'd like to thank Dr. Andrew Urban, who isn't here, but helped me a great deal with preparing this case and teaching me a lot during it. So syphilis has long been regarded as the great imitator, and it is important for contemporary practitioners to be aware of unusual presenting scenarios for this important public health threat. Today I'll review a case of syphilis in a man with a history of HIV and treated lymphoma who presented with severe tibial pain. This 44-year-old gentleman came into our clinic urgently with a four-day history of severe progressive atraumatic unilateral shin pain. That was his only complaint. He has a history of HIV/AIDS diagnosed in 1992 with a baseline CD4 count that was unknown. This was long before he was a patient in our clinic. He had started antiretrovirals about 10 years later in 2002 and then stopped them in January 2008. And was moving throughout the country at this time. He was then out of care for a few years and then returned to our clinic in 2011. When he did come back, he was quite ill at the time. He had melena, weight loss, malaise, and was found to have pancytopenia. His CD4 count was down to 59, and he was subsequently diagnosed with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma of the colon with involvement of the liver, lungs, and pericardium. He also was found to have perirectal CMV with viremia. He underwent six cycles of R-CHOP and was last thought to be in remission. There was no evidence of recurrence. And he had been seen about 2 months before this shin pain by his heme-onc doctor and had imaging that had shown no recurrence. Around the time of the diagnosis of lymphoma, he restarted on antiretrovirals and was put on darunavir, ritonavir, emtricitabine, and tenofovir. And the most recent labs before the shin pain was a viral load of less than 20 and a CD4 count of 125. His physical exam was pretty unremarkable. He looked like his usual self. His vitals were normal, he had no rashes, no joint swelling, no oral or genital lesions. However, he did have exquisite tenderness to palpation of the right tibia, but there was nothing to be seen except for it hurt when you touched it. It seemed actually very consistent with a tibial stress syndrome, except we all knew the patient pretty well and thought that was pretty unlikely given his sedentary lifestyle. So we did a plain film that showed an area of focal periostitis, and that had us worried based on his previous history. So radiology had recommended an MRI, and that showed patchy bone marrow edema with adjacent periosteal and soft tissue edema. So I have these images. I find the change is hard to see, but right here along the tibia where the periosteal changes, I tried to zoom in. It's very subtle. Mm-hmm. You can see it? Oh, okay. Good. So that was the x-ray. And when I talked to the radiologist, he said there were also findings in like the lateral malleolus as well. And then the MRI, the most obvious thing is this soft tissue edema. And then there's no lesions in the marrow, but just this edema around. So we started with some labs, and significant for a mild leukopenia and a mild anemia with a normal platelet count. He had a slightly elevated creatinine, slightly elevated ELK-phos, and an LV that was in the normal range. Antigenic studies for histoplasmosis, blastomycosis, and cryptococcus were all negative, and Bartonella and CMV PCR were negative as well, as were the blood cultures for bacteria and AFB. At this point, we were quite worried about a lymphoma recurrence or an opportunistic infection. Other differentials were myeloma or stress fracture or tibial stress syndrome. And so we had arranged for a bone biopsy for culture and pathology. And then the patient had called again and had progressive pain over the next 3 days, had involvulsions, and now he was complaining of pain in his forearms. He'd been in near daily contact with our nurse during this time because of the development of complaints day by day. But before he got to the biopsy, he called with a new concern. Anybody have any guesses? I think his actual word was, "Do you think I should worry about these spots on my hands?" And he had multifocal, non-tender, erythematous macular lesions. He'd only noticed them on his hands, but he did have them on the soles of his feet and his trunk. They were very faint. So then we kind of changed course at that point, called off the biopsy. We did an RPR. They came back at greater than 1 to 256, and the confirmatory TPPA was reactive. Given his high RPR and low CD4 count, despite no symptoms of neurosyphilis, we did go ahead with an LP. And it was normal, except the VDRL was reactive at 1 to 1. So at this point, we recommended therapy for osseous and neural syphilis and started him on IV penicillin G, 24 million units a day for 14 days, and then followed that up with 3 doses of IM benzene penicillin at 2.4 million units. His pain was completely gone before we'd even finished the IV treatment, as was his rash. And within 3 months, the RPR was down to 1 to 4, which is where it has stayed. So we had to put in some stuff about the osseous manifestations because we were pretty excited about this. So it turns out periostitis is a well-described manifestation of syphilis, but it's quite rarely seen in the acquired syphilis, more common in congenital syphilis, and more common in the later stages of acquired syphilis. The prevalence of bone involvement depends on what study you look at, but the studies that had the greatest number of individuals, it was around 0.2%. There was one study of that only had 80 people in it, but they had found the incidence of up to 9% when they x-rayed patients' skulls. And most common sites are actually the tibia, but also the sternum, skull, and ribs. And we found this article, you can sort of see the date, 1879, for the amount of time that we've been dealing with these syphilis as an imitator. The mechanism is thought to be seeding of the periosteum from hematogenous spread 4 to 8 weeks after infection with subsequent perivascular inflammation. You can see periostitis, osteochondritis, even there's cases of osteomyelitis. Patients often report that the pain is worse at night. And although the optimal therapy is not known, high-dose IV penicillin G seems to be the preferred. So in conclusion, this unique presentation of syphilis serves as a reminder that syphilis has an incredible variety of presentations that continues to humble even the most experienced practitioners. It should always be on the differential when sexually active adults, especially MSM, present with unusual complaints. And education and counseling regarding risk reduction and safer sex practices should never stop despite comorbidities. So.
I'm just going to ask the panelists to go ahead and comment. Khalil, you want to start? Have you seen this? And what do you think about this case?
So, we've seen a couple of cases of bone involvement in syphilis. And it's interesting. It's always been early, and it's always been, at least in our experience, in HIV-positive patients. Mm-hmm. So, it's not surprising. I think the getting a history and an adequate history of risk is what mm-hmm. should drive the the path towards thinking about syphilis. In most cases, it's not. But in rare cases, when the right risk factors are there, I think it's definitely something to consider.
I was thinking that we definitely need to spend more time in counseling. Mm? And I would like to ask you something. How frequently the patients are screened for syphilis? Because sometimes in our clinic we screen in the beginning, and as ID physician we forget to retest them. Right. We are concerned about other stuff.
Right. I think most people's goal is, or most of the providers I work with, the goal is to screen everyone, especially MSM, once a year. I think a lot of people have gotten in the habit of just ordering that lab as part of the routine labs, and sometimes that's actually come up where people have been upset, especially like with gonorrhea, chlamydia screening, if those things are just ordered and not always explained. But I think most people are just trying to make it part of routine. And he had had a non-reactive it was just over a year before. And I think when we talk about this case, we think about how we were kind of just happy he was alive and had sort of thought, had not really realized that he was feeling great and had moved on from his lymphoma diagnosis. And he later cited, because we hadn't really asked at that first visit, but later that he had been participating in oral intercourse, and that was his only risk factor.
I think that's a really critical point. So this is a man who was diagnosed in 1992, clearly lived through some of the big bad old days of the HIV epidemic, right, and now has totally come full circle to sort of start to enjoy sexual health again.
Right.
And so really important reminder to continue to take that history at every visit. I have the same type of clinical population, and I do try to ask them every time. I think a couple of things are worth noting. The HIV Medicine Association in the U.S. recommends screening at least once a year, but probably more frequently based, I mean, definitely more frequently based on risk. So again, you know, but to do the screening, you need to ask the questions. So it's the do ask, do tell, do screen kind of paradigm. So I would say in some of my patients, we're screening at least almost every quarter just because of some of the ongoing sexual activity. The other thing I wanted to, actually let me ask Keith if he wants to comment, because I didn't get to Keith before.
I mean, interesting case. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the three cases presented, all three being gay men, and two out of the three already have HIV, and this shows this problem that's happening everywhere in certainly North America and Europe, doesn't it, of an epidemic really of syphilis in gay men who are already infected with HIV, and similarly with hepatitis C and LGV. I think certainly in the UK now, in most HIV services, we would do syphilis serology at every 3 or 4 monthly visit, really just because you pick up unexpected findings. But in a way, that's relatively easy for us because we should be thinking about those things. But I think what all the cases this morning show is the difficulty when people present to other physicians who, you know, don't routinely take a sexual history and are not particularly aware of how these conditions can present. And I think there's a need for education in each specialty. So for gastroenterologists, they probably need to be more aware of the way that sexually transmitted infections can present as differential diagnosis of proctitis. And I think every specialty has to go through its own little learning curve, doesn't it?
I could not agree more, and I would really add emergency room physicians to the list, because the missed cases that I could start a book of the cases of facial nerve palsies who've come through chronic headache, who's come through the ER, who end up coming to our clinic. And actually, that's a great segue, because I want to ask the audience, of those of you, how many of you are clinicians? Just raise your hand. Okay. How many of you would have performed a lumbar puncture on this patient as this team did? Let's do that again, just so that we can get this discussion going. So the minority, the overwhelming minority. Rose, did you want to say a word about your decision to perform LP? And then I'm going to ask one of our world experts on the topic, Khalil, to comment.
So in the guidelines, there's a suggestion if the RPR is greater than 1 to 30.
You're talking about the CDC guidelines.
In the CDC guidelines, yeah. There's the suggestion to strongly consider it if this RPR is greater than 1 to 32 or the CD4 count is less than 350. And his CD4 count was presumably so low because he had chemotherapy. I mean, he did have a suppressed viral load. So given those two criteria and that we thought he was even more immunosuppressed because of the chemotherapy, we thought that he was just such a high-risk patient and he was willing to undergo it, that we thought it was definitely worth doing. He did not want to do a follow-up LP.
I can't imagine why.
So, but we were okay with that.
Kind of masochist, apparently. Which is probably good. Okay, so I'm going to ask actually Raj, and then Basil, and then Khalil. Does that sound good? And then I think we should open it up for discussion. The one comment I want to make, not about LP, but about the labs you mentioned about how, you know, it's sort of a reflexive thing to order the syphilis serology often because we get labs. You know, we're getting labs much less frequently on these folks.
Yeah.
In fact, the you know, the U.S. the DHHS guidelines are probably going to come out and say you never need to check the CD4 again in a healthy patient. And with viral load so routinely suppressed with these newer regimens, you know,
right,
we're maybe checking it once a year. So I think the opportunity to just check the box for syphilis serology is going to be a little bit less obvious.
Can I just ask how the lumbar puncture can then contributed to his management? Because you decided to do it.
Oh, because the VDRL was positive.
And
or was reactive at 1:1.
At 1:1, and you felt that fulfilled your diagnostic criteria.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We can have Khalil comment on that. Basil.
thanks for that question, Raj. it's worth pointing out there's a very good paper came out of Canada last year where they looked at that elevated RPR and neurosyphilis. And they, in their study population, they limited themselves to early syphilis. And RPR disappeared as an indicator for neurosyphilis. The reason is everyone with early syphilis has an elevated RPR. So I suspect that those guidelines will be changed over the next few years. If you've got someone who's quite likely to have had syphilis for 3, 4, 5 years but haven't been screened in the meantime, then yes, an RPR of over 32 says this is an active infection. This is an unusually active infection for what is probably an old infection. And I think that's probably a much better indicator for LP. But I think the question should always be asked what was actually achieved by that LP. Particularly if you're going to go on and treat someone as neurosyphilis anyway. And this guy is the norm. Everyone refuses to repeat LP because it is not a very nice thing to do to people.
So Christina Morrow was, and she won yesterday the award for her work. Yeah, too bad. So Christina was really the first one to show that there were some criteria that actually makes it more likely among asymptomatic individuals, both symptomatic and asymptomatic. But really the goal here is if you have symptoms, you're going to do the LP anyway. If you have neurological symptoms, you're going to do the LP. That's not an issue. But she was the first to show that these criteria of a high titer greater than 1:32 and a low CD4 count is sensitive at picking up individuals with underlying CSF abnormalities consistent with neurosyphilis. Be careful, I said CSF abnormalities consistent with neurosyphilis. Yeah, well, because I'm being very careful here. This is an area where I've been crucified several times before, so I'm being thoughtful. And so, I don't know about that. But we did the same study, limited to asymptomatic individuals, and we looked at it by early or late, and it actually predicts. So the sensitivity for these criteria, for detecting these abnormalities, is very high. What's the problem? The problem is the specificity. The specificity is terrible. And this is the really interesting, and so in your case, you went ahead, and the CDC guidelines have been very careful to dance around this issue and say, you know, we know that people who have these criteria are more likely to have these CSF abnormalities, but they didn't go ahead and say LP. They put that statement there, and they decided to let you guys decide with your patient what you want to do. And so the issue here being that finding these abnormalities in the antibiotic era and treating them, we don't know, I mean, we're using data from the pre-antibiotic era to say this probably helped the patient in the long term. But in the antibiotic era, treatment of asymptomatic neurosyphilis, and I'm going to here say asymptomatic neurosyphilis, is we don't know whether it prevents it, whether, you know, these patients are going to go ahead and develop abnormalities in the long term. So I think here, the very interesting finding on the LPE, and usually what you get is you get some pleocytosis, 7, 10 white cells, and everything else is normal, and then what do you do in a patient who's HIV positive? In this case, you got what we consider to be a highly specific CSF test, the VDRL. And in fact, Christina and I go back and forth and say, you know, Christina sends me an email and says, have you ever seen a case, have you ever not called a case of neurosyphilis when you have a CSF VDRL that's positive, barring blood contamination? I'm assuming here that this CSF is not blood.
Right, there was no blood contamination and no pleocytosis.
So barring blood contamination, having a positive CSF VDRL, we say is highly specific,
right,
and the diagnosis and makes a diagnosis of neurosyphilis, in this case asymptomatic neurosyphilis.
Right.
So it's a, but whether your treatment made a difference ultimately is not.
And I want to point out that Christina actually just got an R1 and has started in the last year NIH funding to start a study where people like this are going to be randomized. Asymptomatic people with titers like this are going to be randomized to management, either get an LP or not. Mm-hmm. They have to agree to consent to the possibility of RP, and then have management based on either presumptive therapy, not for neurosyphilis if they're asymptomatic, or based on results of LP, and they'll be followed to see what the clinical outcomes are. We have about 4 minutes, so I want to be sure the audience has some time to ask questions, and then Rose, yes, and then Brad.
Well, what about the IV penicillin? I mean, what would you have done for the treatment of just the osseous?
Yeah, I think, I mean, this guy probably would have gotten the IV penicillin anyway, right? Would anybody not have treated him with intravenous penicillin? I mean, he's got invasive, quote-unquote, syphilis.
No, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think the trouble with the treatment of syphilis is that there aren't RCTs on the treatment of osseous syphilis for obvious reasons, are there? But, no, I mean, I think you're right. I think when somebody has aggressive disease, you're going to err on the side of giving a lot of penicillin just to make sure that you treat it properly, aren't you?
Hi, I'm Brad Stoner from Washington University in St. Louis. My question to the panel was they gave IV penicillin followed by 3 weekly shots of benzathine penicillin. And that seemed a little bit excessive to me. And I know the treatment guidelines say for neurosyphilis, 2 weeks of IV penicillin and then possibly 1 dose of benzathine at the end could be considered. And I just wondered not why you did it, but what does the panel think about what was done?
It's that just consider up to 3.
Yeah.
To consider. It's all.
Yeah.
Consider.
I mean, I think I'd probably say the same thing. I don't think we can be certain exactly how much penicillin is right, the best treatment. But when you've got somebody with serious disease, you're going to err on the side of giving more than you think might be required. Because, I mean, unless they're the odd person who's allergic, it's actually a pretty easy thing to do, isn't it? Really. And why take any chances that you might undertreat it? That would be my feeling. But.
Yeah, well, I see where you're coming from, but I think where the guidelines are going with that is in individuals who have a history of late syphilis and neurosyphilis. So we're talking here about tertiary neurosyphilis. And where the background is that if you give them 10 to 14 days of IV penicillin to somebody who has late syphilis, you're not achieving the requisite elevated levels of penicillin in the blood for the 21 to 28 days that it takes, given how quickly the organism replicates in latent syphilis. So the recommendations for 1 or more, and I've never understood the more, but we keep it every year, because with 1 dose after the 14 days, you achieve about 24 or 25 days of reliable levels. And so in this case, he had early syphilis. We know that. And so I don't think I would have given antibiotics in this case to that extra those extra doses of antibiotics.
Any other questions or comments from the audience? We have about a minute. Yes. Let me just bring you the microphone. Just if you could introduce yourself.
Bernard Gilliard, South Carolina Department of Health. Just as a point of information, the CDC has now moved from, for partner services and contact tracing, a specific diagnosis of neurosyphilis. They've called it something else with neurologic involvement so that partners could be followed and identified as a particular stage based on exposure.
Thanks, Rose. What about partners? Were they treated? Were you able to successfully identify and treat?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, I think we should wrap it up. I guess the other thing I want to say about the LP too, just as a final note, is this guy was a little unusual too because of the lymphoma. So that might have, I mean, he was really seriously immunosuppressed, not just with the lymphoma, but with chemotherapy and with the low CD4. So I think erring on the side of the LP is the better part of valor, I guess. Anyway, I think we will wrap it up. I really want to thank our panelists. Thank you very much for your excellent discussion and our wonderful presentation.